Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the July meeting of the Oregon Investment Council. I don't have a gavel here with me, but I am formally calling the meeting to order. We have a short agenda today that consists of two guest speakers that we are very lucky to have join us. And out of respect for their time, we will get right started, and I will hand it over to the folks at Bridgewater. Welcome.
Great, and thank you. Just by way of introductions, I'm Andrew Michalacy. I've been with Bridgewater for 21 years now. I'm a partner here and ultimately responsible for all of our clients in the U.S. and Canada, really focusing on our largest and most sophisticated partnerships in the region, of which Oregon is certainly one of those. And I'm joined by Adil Lele. Adil is the head of our portfolio strategist team. He works very closely with our CIOs and our largest relationships really across the globe. So that includes public pension plans, central banks, sovereign wealth funds, institutions of that stature. He's been with Bridgewater for 8 years and in the industry for 25. And so first off, you know, I want to thank you for inviting us in today and for the continued partnership between our organizations. You know, as I think you know, we view Oregon as a key strategic partner and hope to continue to build on that partnership as we go forward. You know, I think the term strategic partner gets thrown around a lot. And so what we mean by that is really putting ourselves in our client's shoes, understanding their unique circumstances, their goals, their constraints, what's front of mind for them, and then bringing the resources that we have to bear in a tailored and customized way that will hopefully increase the likelihood of achieving your goals. And so there are a lot of forms that that can take, one of those being the conversation that we're going to have today. And so, you know, Rex was kind enough to provide some guidance in terms of how we can be most helpful in terms of sharing our current views on global economies and markets, as well as the implications of those views for your plan, and hitting on both the shorter-term cyclical perspective, but also bearing in mind the longer-term, more strategic considerations. So we've prepared some comments here, but please, we are very flexible, and so whatever areas you want to spend more or less time on, guide us. We're happy to take questions as we go, and I will turn it over to Adil.
Great. Thank you very much, Andrew, and thank you to the Oregon Investment Council. I echo what Andrew spoke about, which is we really value the partnership. My goal in being here today is to be great partners to you and share our thoughts on what's going on in economies and markets today. And as Andrew pointed to, the portfolio implications of that and how we're working with different partners around the world in understanding how to deal with it from a portfolio standpoint. And so with that, I've got some comments prepared on the secular outlook as well as the portfolio implications. We've got 50 minutes. As Andrew said, we're here for you and to be partners to you. And so if you do have a question, given the number of people in the room, probably use the hand raise function within Teams, and I'll pause along the way or after certain sections as well. So with that, I'm going to share screen. And if I could just get a quick thumbs up from people that they can see my screen. Great. Yep. So we're good to go. Okay. So a quick background on how we process economies and markets. And that is that for 50 years now, this year is our 50th anniversary, Bridgewater has been on a mission of deeply understanding economies and markets. So we are fundamental in our approach, which is we try to understand the cause and effect drivers of economies and markets. Markets move for logical reasons that can be understood, and we've spent 50 years trying to deeply understand what those logical reasons are. We're systematic in that approach, which essentially means we write all of that understanding down. That means we can stress test our understanding, and we can diagnose when we get things wrong and ways to improve upon it. And we're diversified in our approach, because any investment manager, whether you've been around for 50 years or whether you started up last week, is going to get things wrong. And so what we aim to have is a set of good return streams that go up over time. They go up at different points in time, and we try and combine our return streams and everything down to our ideas in a diversified way. We apply that investment process, which we've carried for 50 years, to quality investment strategies and to long-term partnership to add value across client organizations. And so that's the way that we operate. That's our investment philosophy. Now I'll jump into how we're seeing economies and markets today. Now, the first thing I'll say is there is just so much happening in economies and markets. And to be able to process everything that's happening, it's important to have a framework. And so a lot of what we'll be touching on today, we anchor back to our framework. And that is over the very long term, the outcome for any economy is going to be driven by its productivity growth. And then there's going to be swings in the fortunes around that based on how much debt an economy takes on or how much it deleverages. Policymakers, monetary, fiscal, and regulatory or macroprudential policymakers, are pulling the levers of the economy that they have at their disposal to constantly try and move the economy towards a point of equilibrium where you don't have inflation running too hot or too cold, where you have debt growth in line with income growth, and where you have assets offering a reasonable rate of return over cash for investors. And policymakers will continue to push and pull on those levers until they hit limits. And this is a particularly important point today when we're seeing around the world fiscal policy expand quite rapidly. And we're really asking ourselves, what are the limits that policymakers face? And as policymakers push and pull at those levers, the liquidity that they inject, for example, into markets and economies, makes its way into asset prices, discount rates fall, assets rise, risk premiums get compressed. That feeds into a rise in economic growth. That feeds into an increase in inflation until policymakers must tighten. Discount rates rise, risk premiums rise, assets fall, growth slows, and so on and so forth. And so this is the machine that we utilize to understand all of these conditions and how they're changing. And as I mentioned, wow, there's a lot changing today. We are in a new world. And that new world is characterized by three major secular dynamics. The first is what we are terming modern mercantilism, an increased role for the state to increase national wealth, strength, and self-sufficiency. And that's seeing a reshaping of the global economic and geopolitical order. Against that, fiscal policymakers are having to respond around the world and even within the US to all of the volatility in economic conditions caused by mercantilism. And indeed, fiscal policy is helping drive mercantilism. And ultimately, there's going to be limits on that. And so we're asking ourselves, what are the limits on those fiscal policy? How sustainable is it? And against this backdrop, we've got the rise of artificial intelligence and the potential productivity miracle that can come with it. And so we believe it's important for investors and policymakers to understand these dynamics, be able to process them and manage the impact on portfolio. Where we net out is this is an incredibly rich environment in terms of opportunities to generate alpha. But also, given how different this world is from the last 15 years, the need to increase portfolio resiliency is as great as ever. And the implications from this environment are shown here, and we'll talk through them probably for the last 10 or 15 so minutes, which is investors should consider geographic diversification, economic environment diversification, tactical opportunities, strategic currency allocation, and just the value of being able to change your mind in this type of environment. And so let's jump into how different this world is from the past, starting with the past. We're in a new world. Today, very different to the last 15 years plus, inflation matters again. Interest rates are back in play. Fiscal policy is increasingly prominent. Globalization is past its peak. We're now in a multipolar world with the rise of China at the center of an Asian economic bloc. And US asset concentration is near all-time highs. And so we are in a new world that's very different to the last 15 years, and most investors aren't set up for it. Most investors are set up for a continuation of the pro-liquidity, pro-growth, pro-corporate, disinflationary environment of global harmony that we've seen for the last 15 years. And that's all changing, and we're seeing it changing right now. And it starts with this notion of modern mercantilism. And so let's define mercantilism. As I said at the outset, it's really the state having increased presence in generating national wealth, strength, and self-sufficiency, but there's key tenets of it. The state's having an increasing role in orchestrating the economy. Trade balances, which is at the center of everyone's attention now with the tariffs, are an important determinant of national wealth. And so trade deficits are seen as something to be avoided. Industrial policy is back to promote self-reliance and defence. National corporate champions are protected. Access to your market is now an asset that should be sold and not given away. And allies who were previously dependent on you and are still dependent on you need to pay tribute. And so how do we process all of this? We think about modern mercantilism and those tenets through the framework I outlined earlier. And the first order implications are clear. There's going to be winners and losers across the economy. It's leading to differences in inflation across the world, a disinflationary impact across most of the world, an inflationary impact in the US, lower growth more generally across the world, reduced profit share of GDP, there's a hit to corporate profits, and then multiple second and third order implications. And so if we think about how we got here before going to what this all means, what I'm showing you here on the left-hand side is a chart that goes back about 600 years, 500 to 600 years. And it shows the relative standing of empires. And we measure the relative standing based on the factors on the right: education, military strength, innovation, technology, and so on and so forth. And so for the better part of 80 years, you've seen the US rise and be the dominant global force. And what we've seen over the last 20 years is the rise of China. So the conflict that we're seeing today is a direct result of the rise of one power challenging another one. And the fact that we're seeing conflict is somewhat inevitable. Any time over the past 500 plus years that you've seen one power challenge another, you see major wars, this gray shaded region. So there's an inevitability to the conflict that we're seeing by virtue of the relative standing of empires shifting. And when I say shifting, it's actually already had started before we saw the Trump presidency. We've seen that globalization in terms of global goods exports, cross-border trade had rolled over. Cross-border capital flows had really plateaued and are starting to roll over, and migration flows have started to turn pretty meaningfully. And so what does modern mercantilism mean, and what is the form it's taken today? It can be summarized in three phrases. Number one, we're seeing more action across more areas and across more countries. What I'm showing you here is a timeline of mercantilist actions across different areas. And what you're seeing is, if you look at what's happened just in the last 6 to 7 months since Trump's second presidency, you've seen more action in the last 7 months than you did in the 2 terms prior to that. You've seen it across more areas than what you did previously. And you're seeing it across more countries. It's not just the US, you're also seeing it across Europe, where there's a lot of mercantilist actions. And China, where arguably there's been mercantilist approaches that you've seen for decades, going all the way back to the 1980s.
Sorry, can I interrupt for 1 second? And I apologize, I cannot find the raise hand function today for some reason.
No problem.
Hi. The thing I'm really baffled by in all of this, because you talked earlier about markets behave logically, right? And they respond logically. And I get that. And I get that governments are not markets, because that's a totally different thing. And yet, the one piece of these tenets that don't make sense, that doesn't make sense to me, is access to your market is an asset to be sold. And I understand why on the surface that looks plausible, but doesn't that end up with mutually assured destruction, because everybody keeps selling access to their markets and everybody's prices go up and we get into an inflationary cycle worldwide, which is terrible for the global economy? Or am I missing something entirely?
No, I think you're actually spot on in terms of, if you take this through to the nth degree, what does it mean in terms of that there's multiple first order and second order implications? If you think about a very clear to us second order implication, though it's not clear in the first order, is inflation, because everyone needs to build their own supply chains. And that building out of supply chains is something that needs capex. That capex in itself is going to be inflationary, even though there may be a third or fourth order impact that isn't. And so We totally agree that the second order impact of this is, yes, everyone needs to build their supply chains. That means capex, that means inflation. You mentioned another word, another phrase that's really important as well, which is, look, doesn't this mean mutually assured destruction? I think what's really interesting is when you look at the flip side of the US saying, okay, you need to now pay for access to our market, what we can do is look at why is the US actually doing that, which is, the US has got this large current account deficit, the blue shaded region, with the rest of the world. And so the US is trying to normalize that. The thing that's, you know, somewhat ignored by this is that, okay, we've already hit on the point that the US now needs to build its own supply chain. And that in itself can be positive. It brings jobs back to the US in terms of manufacturing and so on. What this argument misses, and this is part of the second order impacts of destruction, is the US is also very, very reliant on the rest of the world, not only for goods, but also for capital. And that's an impact that most of the market has not yet to fully appreciate. The US has been importing capital from the rest of the world for really the better part of a couple of decades, and it's really accelerated more recently. And so not only is inflation a second-order impact, but also the potential for capital outflows is a second-order impact. I want to check that I've answered your question before moving on to this really important point about the US being vulnerable as well.
You've at least made me feel like I wasn't missing something entirely. You haven't you've answered my question, but you haven't reassured me in the slightest. Not that I really expected you to, but no, that's good. Thank you.
Great. And so let's move on to, you know, looking at the US and how exposed it actually is. And so if we just look at the impact of tariff policies, because I'm sure that's a question on many people's mind, just that the first order impact on our assessment is we've systematically gone through and looked at, okay, what are the cause and effect linkages of the US raising tariffs? And we've gone through at an individual company level, at an individual good level, made assessments of tariffs. And where that all nets out is you've got various countries across the world that are going to have a hit to growth as a result of tariffs and trade policies. And that's not only the direct impact of tariffs, tariffs are a tax on the consumer, but also business uncertainty of ceasing investment and so on. Then you've got the impact on prices, which, as I mentioned, is more disinflationary across the rest of the world because you get a hit to growth. Their goods are tariffed, they're going to export less and so on and so forth. You also get a hit to corporate earnings that comes as a result. And what's really interesting to note is that the US is pretty exposed from a corporate earnings point. That's in a first order way, but also in a second order way. The US generates around 40% of its earnings from the rest of the world. So it is now very, very vulnerable to retaliation. And so the US finds itself in a first order way being impacted by tariffs to the tune of around 4%. And that's just from the retaliatory tariffs that we know of right now. But there's plenty more that could come in the form of digital service taxes and so on. As well as that, the US, as I mentioned earlier, is very reliant on the rest of the world for capital. This is the rest of the world in terms of our major allies, Europe, China, Canada, Japan, the allocation of equities and bonds. So we're looking at around pretty large holdings, around $7 trillion when you look at the equity market, and even more when you're looking at the bond market. And when we look at the degree of those holdings, it is huge, and it has started to turn. Foreigners have started to pull back the amount of capital that are allocating into the U.S. And so this is a real impact that we need to consider, and it speaks to the heart of whether the U.S. will continue to be the exceptional country in terms of being able to attract not only people, not only ideas, but also capital to go and fund all of that. So against this big mercantilist push, there's also coming fiscal policy. In the U.S., it's the recycling of some of these tariffs. And so you've seen the One Big Beautiful Bill being passed, which adds to the deficit that the U.S. already has, the tariffs only providing a partial offset. As well as that, you're seeing fiscal action from across the world to combat it. Part of that fiscal action is because countries within Europe, Germany being at the forefront, recognizing that if the US is not going to be spending as much on defending Europe, Germany and the rest of Europe will need to increase its own defenses. And what I'm showing you here on the left-hand side is just military expenditure. The US is genuinely spending a lot. And we estimate that China and Russia are increasing theirs, as well as Europe is going to increase their military expenditure. That defense spending is being increased. It's coming at the expense of an expanded budget deficit and budget rules being ignored, in addition to the fiscal responses that various countries, as I'm showing along the bottom panel, are having towards the tariffs. And so what we're seeing here is a big push towards modern mercantilism. That mercantilism necessitates some increased spending, so an expansion in fiscal deficits. It also necessitates a fiscal offset to the growth hit. And so the big question from here is, how sustainable is this fiscal expansion? which leads us to the second big topic that's front of mind for us. I just want to pause here, check if there's any questions on that first area before I keep moving.
I have one question. You mentioned the 40% number, and you're going fast, so I just want to make sure you're getting everything you're saying. The 40% number that you mentioned, the U.S. earns 40%. So how, of that 40%, who are the biggest blocks? Is it the EU and then China? And I'm just trying to think about the risk from a geographic fragmentation perspective.
Yeah, so so the left-hand chart here we show, and my apologies for moving quickly, I'll slow down going forward. Predominance is coming from Europe, the red line here, and then China, and then Canada and Mexico are the large blocks where we're seeing that earnings come from. And so and you hit on the point of the geographic fragmentation, which is absolutely something we're seeing, which is the outcrop of this push for mercantilism is a world that's moving from globalization to really a multipolar world. And that multipolar world feeds directly into, okay, the portfolio implications. How should we deal with that? How should we think about a multipolar world? And how should we even think about US exceptionalism, which I'm going to definitely touch on later on as well.
Thank you.
I have a question, and I'm kind of like Elizabeth Treasure Steiner. Perhaps I need another cup of coffee. With that said, given the implications of what you just shared about the tariffs, it's what's brewing in my brain is like, what's the end game here? And so can you speak? Oh, okay. Here we go. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, look, in terms of what the end game is, when we think about what the end game is, we think about it in terms of, okay, what are the first, second, third order implications? Because trying to get towards the end game, from every first order implication, there's going to be other forks in the road that can lead you to multiple second or third order implications. And so I'll run through just what the first order implications are. And then I think it's worth touching on the second. And then I'll definitely get to, look, what do we think the end game would be probabilistically? Okay. And so the first order is, we are seeing winners and losers across economies. And so you can see economies like the US winning in certain aspects with regards to certainly having a narrower trade deficit, for example, and losers, those who are supplying to the US, actually having fewer exports going to the US. And winners and losers within economies as well. For instance, those who are in the manufacturing sector in the US would benefit more. Those who are consuming kind of on the margin actually suffer because they're facing higher costs. As an example, as well as that, when we think about the first order implications, there's going to be the headwind that you face to productivity growth. Now, when you just look at, and one of your colleagues asked the question earlier, which is this all inflationary? In the near term, it's disinflationary because if you introduce a tax, such as a tariff, which is a tariff is a tax, what you end up seeing is slower growth. Whenever you tax someone, you're going to get them consuming less. And so in the near term, you're going to get a hit to growth. And because of the drag on growth, the hit to inflation around most of the world, increased inflation in the US. Longer term, you are going to necessitate more building of supply chains, and so it will be inflationary. There's a downward pressure on corporate profits. And so on the one hand, there's the state promoting industrial policy and national corporate champions. But against that, you are potentially going to see more of the benefits of productivity accrue to the government. And less going actually to corporations. And so you can see that if a corporate was previously manufacturing offshore with a lower cost base, they now manufacture in the US, the cost base is higher, they're going to have narrower profits. And so less corporate profits is one of the first order impacts. And then if we think about some of the second order implications, as we mentioned, inflation is one, more business uncertainty is a first order that feeds into a second order, less building around the world, less business fixed investment around the world. And if we think about kind of where the end game is, as I mentioned earlier, it is a world that is more multipolar and a world that has far more conflict. It is a world that is less pro-corporate. It's a world that's less disinflationary. And so that's where we net to This, coupled with some of the other pressures that we're seeing that I'm about to get into, leads us to a world that is very different to the last 15 years. The last 15 years saw a world where you had disinflation. That's gone. Where you had a pro-growth set of outcomes that you were seeing from policy. That's more under question. A pro-corporate environment. That's more under question. An environment of global harmony. That's clearly under question. And so the pro-growth, pro-liquidity, disinflationary environment of global harmony is very much over. And so the end game is something that looks very different to the last 15 years. And so the key is for investors to be prepared, which I'll talk about in the portfolio implications section. Does that help kind of map out the kind of first order, the second order, and then what a potential end game would be?
Yeah, thanks for taking the time and giving me your perspective. So, yes, thanks.
Right. So in the interest of time, let's move to fiscal sustainability. And so what we've seen is a big fiscal push from the US and a big fiscal push from other countries around the world as well. And the questions that are raised and the comments that you see on the headlines of newspapers are, okay, well, is this something where the debt to GDP is X percent? You know, we've got to all be very, very worried. And so what we're doing to try and process this is, again, thinking about what are the policy levers that are being pulled, where are policymakers trying to move us, and what are the limits? And the limits are not big numbers like debt to GDP. The limits are prices. Policymakers can keep stimulating until we get too much inflation, so prices move too high for goods and services, until you get currency devaluation, the price of your currency falls too much, or until you get asset bubbles, the price of assets goes too high. And against these limits, you've got offsets, productivity being a large one, how many domestic savings being another, and what's the institutional credibility that you have to counter these limits. And so let's go into what these limits literally look like. And I'm going to contrast the US, where many people are concerned about the limits, with a country like Brazil, where they are genuinely up against the limits. And so, as I mentioned, the limits are inflation, the FX, or currency, and asset prices. In the US, inflation is coming down. It's still above target, but not really a huge limit just yet. If we were seeing it persistently higher, it certainly would be. You are seeing that asset prices are elevated, but we're not in bubble territory. And there's certainly no concerns from a longer-term perspective about the currency, but they are starting to creep in. And so these are the limits that we're watching. I want to contrast that to a country like Brazil, which is very clearly above the limits. Inflation is way outside of the target band. Assets are very expensive, so this is showing that risk premiums are very narrow in negative territory in Brazil. And the real exchange rates are quite low, at multi-year lows. And so from that perspective, that's just a contrast, a country that looks like it is up against the limits. And when we scan across the world, different countries are at different levels in the limits. And so this is how we process it. And my goal here is
to... Sorry to interrupt. Can you go back to that other slide just for a minute? Maybe this is a question you're going to get to, but... all of these limits, I mean, trend lines are important, right? I mean, obviously, we've had period. If you look at the U.S. FX, for example, between 2010 and now, you see rise and fall, but fundamentally, the trend line is up. And now it's looking like the trend line is level and maybe starting to trend down. And how do you think about predictive modeling that will tell you, I mean, if you look at core inflation, which is coming down, but last month's numbers weren't, they were worse than the month before, and our risk premiums coming way down, how do you think about, as a policymaker, and I get that you guys aren't policymakers, but how should policymakers be thinking about where we are in all of these trends? Because to my mind, I mean, we haven't seen currency devaluation like the U.S. dollar for a while, right? So it makes me anxious that we're trending in the wrong direction, but maybe I'm overreading this.
Yeah, so I'll answer the second.
Oh, and I'm, just as an aside, I'm treasurer signing, by the way. Hi. Sorry for not introducing myself earlier.
No, I kind of gathered that through some of the follow-up comments. So So I'll answer the second piece of it first, which is kind of what we're seeing, and then I'll turn to the first part, which is putting ourselves in policymaker's shoes. And so what are we seeing? Firstly, we are seeing that inflation is you know, somewhat persistently above where it needs to be. And so that is something where it is coming down just in the latest inflation report, because you did reference it with regards to auto prices. Auto prices are coming down, but some of that is as a result of there was some pre-ordering earlier on before the tariffs came in. If we look at actually the tariff-exposed goods, so imported goods, actually inflation was a little bit higher than what most of the market would have expected. So in terms of the shape of inflation, you are seeing the tariffs impact. Inflation is coming down, but look, it is persistently high. And so that's going to place limits on how much policymakers, predominantly the Fed, can actually go and ease policy rates from where we are today. If we think about the FX, policymakers need to be very mindful that they maintain credibility. And that is that they're not going and undertaking actions that are destructive to the point of foreign capital does not want to come in and invest in the US, which is literally part of how the US exchange rate is set. It's going to be set through a mix of goods and services and capital that's flying across borders. And so that's the way that we would be thinking about it, which is looking at this picture, and I'm looking at it across the world because I want to go to the UK as an example. The UK is an example where you've got inflation, which is above and expected to stay above. The green dot above the red line is kind of leading inflation relative to target is still above. You've got asset prices that aren't terribly attractive. So the earnings yield relative to bond yield is below what it's been in 30-year average, which means it's kind of less attractive in assets. And you've got the exchange rate, which is expensive, which is really the only thing that's providing an offset to that. But there are real risks about capital flowing out of the UK. And so policymakers should be watching all of these keenly and making sure that they're not, and this answers the first part of your questions, making sure that they're not putting in policies that are actually leading us further towards our limits. So as an example, it would be stimulating fiscally and monetarily even more to stoke inflation before it's come down. It would be having fiscal and monetary policy that basically goes and juices asset returns as opposed to leading to product investment, and having policies that undermine the credibility of their institutions and also the credibility of investing in that country. I'm going to jump straight to what does that really look like if I was in your shoes as a state treasurer, and then you can kind of extrapolate that to a country level, which is the key is policymakers should be thinking about stimulating in ways that are productive. And so how would you go and assess that? On a backwards-looking basis, what I'm doing here is I'm looking at a range of countries across the world, how much fixed asset investment they've undertaken, how productive that fixed asset investment was, and whether it was enough to cover the interest expense. And what you can see is there's countries like, I'll take China as an example, a lot of fixed asset investment, it went into productive activities, and certainly enough to cover their interest expense. Good. I'll use Brazil again as an example. Quite a lot of fixed asset investment, wasn't really going into productive activities, and they've got this huge interest bill. And so putting ourselves in policymakers' shoes, they should be really actively thinking about, okay, we're injecting all this fiscal stimulus. Where is it going? Is it going to productive activities? And what you've seen is around the world, there's been large changes in fiscal deficits. There's been an increase in supply, so change in quantitative tightening. So that's the opposite of quantitative easing. You're seeing that essentially by central banks not buying as many bonds and actually selling the bonds, that's adding more supply of treasuries to the market. And they're increasing their supply of treasuries to go and fund these deficits. And so a lot of supply is coming on, and that supply really has two impacts. Number one, if there's more supply of the bonds versus demand coming from the rest of the world or private citizens, the cost of capital is going to go up. So the cost of capital going up is number one, the cost of borrowing. What that can also do is it can result in a crowding out of the private sector. As in the fiscal policymakers are borrowing so much, rates go up so much, there's not enough capital to go around to then go and fund the private sector. And you are starting to see that in the US, where the term premium, which is how much you're paying essentially at the long end, has gone up recently, and the total amount of borrowing, so led by private borrowing, has actually come down. And so these are the things that policymakers should be watching, which is number one, are they going and investing in productive assets? And number two, are they actually inducing policies that are resulting in an increase in the term premium, raising the cost of capital, and detracting from private borrowing? Now, the big question from here is, wow, there's a lot of fiscal stimulus coming. Is it going to be productive or not? And so when you look at things such as handouts that go to consumers, look, in a second order way, that can be productive. But really, when we look at things like defense spending, okay, that can be really productive. If you're looking at investments into such as things such as artificial intelligence, wow, that could be really productive from where we are today. And that's the big question for where we are today. Is this fiscal stimulus going to be going to productivity growth increasing in the US and globally? Because you need that productivity growth to bring inflation down to the target levels that policymakers want and to what markets are pricing in today, as I'm showing here on the right-hand side. So maybe from here I'll move on to artificial intelligence, and then I'll spend just a few minutes on this because I think it's been a topic covered pretty widely, and then we'll come to the portfolio implications. And so if we start on artificial intelligence, firstly, why are we even having this conversation? What I'm showing you here is the AI progress on various arenas versus humans. Handwriting recognition, speech recognition, natural language inference, competition level mathematics. And so 15 years ago, if we were having this discussion, we would have been talking about handwriting recognition, and really the only people who would have been really excited about it were those who worked in the post office, because you're getting handwriting recognition. Today, we're at the point where, wow, we are really seeing that artificial intelligence is competing with humans at the upper echelons of mathematics and other complex analytical tasks. So far, the artificial intelligence spend has been driven almost entirely by the US. And so what I'm showing is the spending that's coming in terms of S&P 500 capital expenditure. Most of it's come from the US. Which is why I'm showing the S&P 500, and most of it's actually just come from the Magnificent Seven companies who are really spending heavily on capital expenditure. So we're only just scratching the surface of the amount of capital expenditure on artificial intelligence that can come, and we're only really seeing it in the US right now. And so far, we haven't really seen it increase productivity growth, although we believe that we will see a productivity miracle from here. Now, importantly, as it applies to market pricing, you do need to see a productivity miracle come through or something similar to justify what's being priced in to certain companies in the US market and even for the US relative to the world. What I'm showing you here is a chart that shows the trailing earnings growth of the Magnificent Seven and the rest of the S&P 493, which is the red line, and how much earnings growth is required to just earn a normal risk premium or rate of return for the Magnificent Seven and then for the rest of the S&P 500. And so for the Magnificent Seven, you need to see pretty strong earnings growth continue from where we are today to justify current market pricing. That actually to us looks pretty possible. And for the rest of the S&P 500, so the S&P 493, you do need to see much stronger earnings growth on a forwards-looking basis. And so from where we are today, you do need to see fairly strong earnings growth, and so a lot of those productivity gains coming through to the rest of the S&P 500 to justify where we are, and a lot to come through for the US to justify its pricing relative to the rest of the world. And so we really need to see this productivity growth come through.
Can I ask a quick question? This is Kara Samples.
Sure.
What are you considering a normal risk premium?
Yeah, so what we're doing there is thinking about the average risk premium that you would have seen think about it as the earnings yield relative to bond yield. And so, you know, if we think about the earnings yield relative to bond yield or earnings yield relative to cash, that particular chart was showing earnings yield relative to cash. And so if we think about earnings yield, bond yield, the 30-year average in the US was 3%. If we think about that relative to cash, it would be somewhat higher than that.
Thank you.
And so that's what we need to see occur for the US. And the thing that we caution about is that on a backwards-looking basis, the US has had superior productivity growth. And it leads the world in technology, in terms of the US share of tech earnings globally, And in terms of tech companies, the US share of technology companies globally from a market cap perspective. On a forward-looking basis, though, that's not guaranteed. If we look at all of the different AI models that are out there, and I've shown them on the left-hand side of this chart, it's not just the domain of the US. R1, shown here, is a Chinese model. And if we look at the scoring, and this is the ELO score, is essentially the way we can describe it is think of it like March Madness between artificial intelligence models, which is they go and compete on increasingly hard levels of tasks. And you can see that DeepSeek, the Chinese model, is really not that far away from ChatGPT. And so tech dominance is no longer the domain of the US. It is broadening out globally. And so we hope that we'll see a productivity miracle from this. It's certainly something that we're spending a lot of time and investment on at Bridgewater. But it is what's needed to really justify market pricing in the US. And as I mentioned, it's no longer the domain of the US.
So can I ask one more? I thank you for your patience with all the questions.
No problem.
So you're talking about the need for increased productivity due to AI, which everything I've read recently suggests fairly significant job loss for some of the tasks that AI can do perfectly well and we now use human beings for. Now, this is not the first time that technology disruptions have led to job loss in industries, but I'm not sure that I could be wrong, but I don't know that we've ever seen a displacement as significant as what we're likely to see with AI, assuming that the predictions are plausible. And then the question becomes, we talk about onshoring, manufacturing, and all those kinds of things. That takes time, and those jobs are not necessarily at the same level, and people who are currently in lower-level white-collar jobs may well not want to switch to manufacturing jobs, and it's unclear whether there's going to be enough of those to make up for the job loss. So how do you think about that in the context of all the other factors that you've been talking about and the implications on the economy and therefore on how we think about portfolios?
Yeah,
and maybe that may be outside the scope of this presentation, and if so, tell me so, and our chair samples can tell me that. But it seems relevant to the conversation we're having if we're talking about inflationary pressures and purchasing power.
Yeah, I think it's outside the scope. We're here for you, and it's okay. Certainly something we've thought about. So I'll answer it quickly, and we're happy to follow up. I want to make sure
That's
we get
fine.
To the portfolio implications as well, which is, look, it's really incumbent upon governments to think hard about what the impacts of this displacement are going to be. And that feeds into the question around fiscal policy as well, which is how is fiscal policy going to be used? It can be used towards productivity, but maybe we have to start to think about such things as universal basic income to provide some kind of offset to the huge displacement that we expect to see, as well as that governments need to think very carefully about regulation. In Europe, that's certainly occurring, where governments are thinking about regulation and the degree to which not only AI can be used, but also the degree to which you allow it to be used, because there are going to be the displacement effects. So it's something that will certainly feed into not only inflation, as you point out, productivity can be an offset. You can have offsets against that. But as well as that, thinking about where is consumption going to go from here? Where are incomes going to go from here? How much of the gains from that productivity go to corporations? How much of it actually goes to consumers? And will the incomes be enough to satisfy the spending and so on and so forth? Or will the government have to supplement those incomes in a similar way to what happened during COVID? And so that's the way that we're thinking about it right now, which is how a fiscal policymaker is going to respond.
Thank you.
Now, mindful of time, I'll just touch briefly on the portfolio implications of the new world. And what I'd say is, firstly, we've described a new world. And if I think about the old world, what I'm looking at is a 70-30 portfolio over every 15-year period since 1970. And the last 15 years was the single best 15-year period you've ever experienced. And it was a period of significant outperformance of US equities as well. which dominate most 70-30 portfolios. So against the backdrop of the last 15 years, portfolios have been reshaped. If we look at the average allocations from a portfolio in 2008 relative to 2024, you've seen an increased concentration in the US, you've seen an increased concentration in private assets, you've seen an increased concentration in growth-sensitive assets. And so what we look at today is, what can investors do about the world that we're in? And to us, there's several levers that investors can pull. The first is thinking about geographic diversification. And if we were just to consider what a typical 70-30 portfolio looks like versus the global share of GDP, they look vastly different. And to us, this suggests increasing allocations predominantly to Asia, because Asia is the place where we see not only increased longer-term growth and, for what it's worth, an attractive entry point, but also Asian assets are highly diversifying to most traditional portfolios. If we look at the conditions and policy in Asia and its correlation to the US, say, relative to geographically diversifying to another developed market, ex-of Asia, you can see that it's far more lowly correlated, so it's more diversifying. And the asset returns, backwards looking, have also been very diversifying as well. And so geographic diversification is lever number one. The second is economic environment diversification. If we think about that same traditional portfolio, that 70-30 portfolio, it's biased to do well in periods where growth is strong, where inflation is falling, and where you're getting plenty of liquidity in markets, policymakers are easing, but it does weaker in environments of falling growth, weaker in environments where you've got higher inflation, and it's very vulnerable to liquidity being withdrawn from markets. And so we're working with partners around the world, as Andrew mentioned, in advising them to consider increasing allocations to assets that protect against higher inflation, even though your liabilities may be capped in terms of the inflation adjustment that they experience, as your plan is, to an extent, your assets are going to be exposed. And so think about protecting against higher inflation. If you have a growth-sensitive portfolio, as most portfolios are, think about increasing your exposure to bonds. Bonds now have a rate of return. They now have a yield that is attractive that can provide an offset if you get slower growth. And really strongly consider allocating to investments that can mitigate your vulnerabilities, which is tightening. If you get a liquidity withdrawal, like you saw in 2022, when all assets fell and all assets were correlated, that's an environment where you need to either go to cash, but that won't help you meet your return targets, or look at opportunities that can diversify against that. So the ability to go short, for example, has been one of them. So that's economic environment diversification. Connected to that is thinking about tactical opportunities, as I mentioned, and I think we're all experiencing. Wow, the world is moving so rapidly and changing so rapidly. And so from our seat, staring down across 200 different markets across the world that we look at, we see that there's huge opportunities. At the short end of the interest rate curve, rates are back above zero. There's lots of opportunities there. Bond volatility is back. There's lots of currency opportunities, with currencies moving away from fair value, with all the big divergences growing between countries. And there's large divergences in equity markets as well. And just by investors allocating a small amount towards good and uncorrelated source of alpha, you can have an increase in your return to risk ratio. Second to last, although you're a US plan, it is really important to consider your currency allocation. And so for most investors around the world, we're saying to them, think about how much exposure you have to the US dollar. But for investors within the US, certainly those with offshore exposures, now think about the degree to which you want to shift the amount you're hedging. Think, and the way we would be thinking about that, and there's a lot on this page, but what I'll show you is, think about what where your savings are, obviously in the US, your future spending, it's going to be in the US. But think about where long-term wealth is going to be around the world. Backwards looking, the wealth creation's been in the US. Forwards looking, will it still be there? Will it be in the US dollar? Will it be in other storeholds of wealth? And even though you're a US dollar investor, I think it is worth considering, okay, to what degree could other currencies start to rise versus the US dollar? How is that going to go and inform your hedging profiles on your overseas investments? And then finally, we'd really prioritise the value of being able to change your mind. And it's certainly been a good period. If I kind of look back over the last 20 years, there's been ups and downs along the way. It's been a good period for private investments, for private assets, private equity or private credit. But when we look at private assets, private equity, private credit, infrastructure, and I look at the environmental biases they have, they have the same environmental biases as public assets. Equity-centric investments, whether public or private, do poorly in periods where growth falls and comes in below what's discounted. They do poorly in periods where liquidity is tightening, where discount rates tighten, where risk premiums rise. And so there's certainly good opportunities to be had in some of those years after you see a big dislocation in markets. Indeed, post the financial crisis, it was one of the best periods in terms of the IRR for buyout funds. But wow, it's important to be able to change your mind rapidly. And so we would place a premium on liquidity again, rather than the illiquidity premium that kind of got built in over the last few years, and be thoughtful, because there's going to be plenty of opportunities that come from this. So it's not to say don't invest in private assets, but just be ready to be able to change your mind. And so we've talked about a lot today. There's a lot of implications that come from this. We hope that it's this discussion's been a real source of insight and help through the very turbulent world that we're in. We also hope that the portfolio implications provides opportunities for us to be able to partner with Oregon on a forward-looking basis as well, and we'd love to be able to help in any way that we can.
Yeah, and the last point I would just make on that is, you know, we talked about strategic partnerships up front. That is not something that we take lightly, and so please do feel free to use us as a resource in any way that we can be helpful. I know Treasurer Steiner had asked about the displacement effects of AI. That is absolutely an area that we've looked into deeply. We need to as a global macro investor, and so we have teams that we would be happy to set you up with to have conversations at whatever level of detail you'd like to go to. If there are other aspects either that we cover here or that we did not that you'd like our thoughts on or even just to bounce ideas off of, please do feel free to reach out. We are here and more than happy to help in any way that we can.
Thank you so much, Atul and Andrew, for being here with us today. Really appreciate this presentation. As Treasurer Steiner said, might raise more questions than answers. But I want to give everyone the opportunity. Are there any more questions from the council or staff?
No, that was amazing. Thank you.
No questions. No questions that I can put together succinctly right now, but great presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and good luck with really the helpful rest of the day, and we look forward to talking soon.
Thanks. Great. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. See you soon.
Okay, the next thing we have on our agenda is a guest speaker from KKR. Do we have Henry McVeigh on the line?
I think Henry will be on at 10 o'clock, so if we want to take a quick pause, I think that might be good, and then we could let Henry and Tony from KKR settle in.
Great.
Hey, Rex. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Pia.
Rex, I forgot to ask, are those materials available, Bridgewater, the presentation?
Let me connect with them post.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Let's take a six-minute break and convene here slightly before 10, and we'll try to get started right at 10.
Right.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone. Okay, welcome back, everyone. The second item on our agenda is another guest speaker, again, sharing their current economic and market perspectives. And we will get right to it. Before we start, just for everyone to know, I'm going to have to leave likely prior to the speaker finishing, so I apologize. I will ring off without disrupting the speaker, and Rex can wrap the meeting for everyone. And with that, go ahead, Bridgewater. Thank you so much for being
KKR.
I apologize. Thank you so much for being here, and we'll hand it over to KKR.
Great. Okay. It's Henry McVeigh from KKR. I've been a partner at the firm for about 14 years. I'm joined by Tony Haas, who's also a partner at KKR, and we appreciate the opportunity and appreciate the support. I'm going to spend we actually just published our mid-year outlook today, so you're my you guys are the guinea pig on kind of running through what we're saying and doing. But on a serious note, not that much has changed in our view. If you think about it, we've been talking about since COVID this idea of a regime change, which is this time is different, right? Most of us grew up in a world of low growth, low inflation, tight fiscal, loose monetary. You had active intervention by the central banks. That's not where we are. We've got this movement from kind of benign globalization to one of great power competition. We think this time is different. There's a regime change. There's too much money still in the system. And ultimately, you have heightened geopolitics and you've got stickier inflation. And so the way we've been thinking about it is that we've really tried to focus on areas where we have some form of pricing visibility. We tried to focus on where we've had operational improvement, and we tried to be right about the big top-down themes, security of everything, capital-heavy to capital-light business models where we can help facilitate that, really focused on productivity. I started in the business in 1991. I wasn't around for the 1960s, but when you look at the great decades of the capital markets, the 60s and 90s, and what we've seen so far in this decade, it's really been driven by productivity, and we think that continues to be a point of differentiation in the U.S. In terms of things we're worried about, I think there's more risk to the dollar than there is to rates going up, and I think that when you look at AI spending, and I think it's going to be a huge technology, I think it's some of it's going to end badly. We're already spending 5% of GDP on AI. That's on par with the dot-com bubble as well as the housing bust. So, kind of leads me to my final point. What are we trying to do from an asset allocation standpoint? We remain constructive on markets. I think the cycle will go longer and go further than most people think. But we're really, in our private equity business, spending a lot of time on public to privates, corporate carve-outs, things where we can have operational improvement. And infrastructure very much focused on this idea of having downside protection with upside skew and making sure that we've got contracted revenues. And then in credit, being higher up in the capital structure and kind of taking advantage of some of the dispersions that President Trump and the administration are creating. So simple view, but I think that we're not in the camp that now's the time to migrate to the sidelines. I know there's lots of things you could get worried about, but again, I come back to productivity cycles are different. This one's going to be longer and stronger than most think. And by the way, like I welcome any questions, both either supporting of facts or if you want to try to just debate or refute, that's okay with me. Okay with me too. So the past 2 years we've had our piece be the glass is half full. When you look, there's obviously been a lot of hand wringing year to date, but when you look at most markets, they're performing. Clearly the non-US markets are doing better than the US. We think that trend, continues, but, and it gets to our overall view, the dollar is probably somewhere between 15 and 20% overvalued, but we've tried to carve out some of the noise that's been taking place and ultimately focus on these big investment opportunities. And my gut is that's going to continue to be the narrative over the next couple of years, because I don't see President Trump or his administration really quieting down. I think they're going to try to use strength in the economy or strength in the markets to push their competitive advantage. That's part of their strategy. But at the end of the day, they're for lower taxes. They're for tough policy on China, more power to the states, and ultimately deregulation. And those policies, if they're enacted right, should be favorable for markets. We usually get a lot of questions around tariffs. We came into this with 4%. Our base view pre-election was it was going to be 11. President Trump came out with 26 on April the 2nd. We've been moderating between 15 and 17%. I've really tried to spend time. I've been to Mexico. I've been to China twice. I'll go back to China Sunday night. Been to Europe three or four times. Really spend time with the governments trying to figure out how's this, and obviously a lot of time in D.C., like, how's this all going to work out? I think tariffs are both a revenue source. I think they're also a negotiation. Some people think they're one or the other, but I believe they're both. I think that he's really going to focus on sections 232 and 301. My view is this administration views automotives, pharmaceuticals, shipping, steel and aluminum, semiconductors as key areas where the U.S. government and country post COVID need to produce, have some production capacity on shore. And some of the things I think will be deemed illegal, but I think those things will be, whether it's Republican or Democrat, I think they're gonna push more for those policies. So I lay out our base case here, which is now about 17%. We think that's kind of a couple hundred billion dollars of revenues for the government. And clearly, you know, we think that most people that trade with the U.S. will have about a minimum a 10% tariff. What I think is important to communicate both to our government as well as to investors is that what President Trump is trying to accomplish on the right-hand side in goods, where we've got about $1.2 trillion deficit, is only part of the story, right? If you simplify our goods deficit, 80% of our deficits comes into capital goods. Think about washing machines, autos, think about what you drive around in, and electronics, think about iPhones and computers. 80% of it is those three buckets. It gets talked about a lot of different things, but that is the heart of our current account deficit in goods. The offset of that is we've got a fabulous services economy. Somewhere between 80 and 90% of our job growth comes from services. About 60% of our economy comes from services. And there are lots of numbers on the left-hand side, but the punchline there is that our $300 billion services surplus actually makes more money than our $1.2 trillion goods deficit. And so part of this, as we try to narrow the goods deficit, is not killing the services economy. I don't think that's going to happen, but whether you're Republican or Democrat, not enough people are talking about that, right? We've got, when you look at the profitability across financial services, IP, business services, that's the heart and soul of the American economy. Again, it's 60%+ of our economy. It's about 80%+ of our jobs. Last month, services was actually 96% of our job growth. So it's really important that we, and it's also our most profitable part of our economy, and it's differentiated globally. So we spend a lot of time talking to government officials about the goods, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention the services.
So can I interrupt for a second here? Treasurer Steiner, by the way, hi. Thanks for being here. I asked this question in the preceding presentation from Bridgewater, and I'm going to ask it again now. If you look at the services sector, I think, and I'm not an expert on this, but I think that we're going to see a bunch of those core services jobs displaced as AI really comes into its own, right? The sort of lower level white collar jobs that involve a lot of repetitive things that are ripe for automation and AI use. And I guess my question then becomes, how is our surplus in services offset by the economic loss associated with job loss in the economy? And how do we think about that?
So this is a great question. I have a little more of an optimistic view, and I'll give that to you, which generally, when you look at our economy, healthcare and education are about 50% of the job growth. Then you throw in travel and leisure, you get it to about 80%. And then the government last month, it was 70,000 jobs out of the 147 or 149. And that was really around education too, because we're shrinking at the federal level. I don't think, given the demographics, that you're going to have total displacement of those jobs. I think some of the things around professional services, you will see, and then things are, you know, that would include legal documentation, call centers, things like that. I think there's real vulnerabilities. I think the second point is that given what's happening with demographics, we believe, and it's in our piece that we published tonight, if you can't sleep, Tony, we can send it to you, but we only need about 50,000 jobs right now to keep the unemployment at 4.2%. Nobody's talking about that, right? Our demographic picture, ex immigration, is woeful. And so what's happened this cycle is we've actually kept a lower unemployment rate. The point that I think you're highlighting that I'm hyper-focused on, and I think it's in the deck, but I'm not going to flip all the pages, but it's certainly in the piece, is when you think about our government today, we spend 1/10 to 1/20 of what most developed markets do on worker retraining. So it's a huge focus for our private equity business and our impact business, and we've found some really interesting things to do. But that's where we're most exposed. Out of the most recent survey, there were 33 countries that were analyzed, and we finished number 32 with only Mexico below us. Europe spends about 2 to 3 times on government worker retraining. Given how indebted our country is, that's something that's going to have to be taken over by the private sector. So I would say that I start from a probably more optimistic base, but it's really based on demographics and where the job growth is coming from. But I fully acknowledge about what you're talking about on the certain parts of the services side, certainly professional services. And I think that's something where we're going to need more government and private sector help to do that. So that would be my response.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Okay. Kind of put it in order, you know, back to the point on why I don't think the government can do a lot. When you look at, and this ties into unemployment rate, when you look at the deficit relative to unemployment rate, we're dwarfing what we did during the Vietnam War, and we're dwarfing what we did during World War II. And so you've got some, typically when you have this type of low unemployment, you would shrink your deficit, and we're obviously not doing that. So hopefully we grow our way out of it. We, in our piece we published, typically when you have big deficits, we went and looked all through history. A couple of things to highlight. One is you typically don't get debt crises in developed markets till 150% of GDP, which we're not there yet. But in the interim, when countries do delever, what you see is the currency on the right-hand side goes down. We're starting this debt episode really with the currency probably 20% overvalued. So it's the third most expensive in the last 55 years. So to me, you know, all you can do with asset allocation is you can tilt, right? And so one of our tilts is to, for the first time, to own a little more non-U.S. I'm not in the camp, given my productivity views, I'm not in the camp that the U.S. massively underperforms. I just think there's some really cheap markets. I think Europe's going to go further than people think. I think Japan continues to be, on the private side, our best market by far. And I think India will be another major beneficiary given its large consumption market. This kind of puts that in perspective, which is every time there's a villain in the story, you know, I did financial services for 13 years before doing macro. Typically, it's the consumer or the corporate. This time it's the government. You see that on the left-hand side. So I'm trying to find things in my portfolio where I'm not levered to the government's indebtedness, right? Just the same way you wouldn't go buy, if a bank needed to delever, a corporation needed to delever, you wouldn't go get long that. But the consumer, and I'll jump ahead a little bit, you see this right here. What people aren't talking about is overall government debt in aggregate in the U.S. is actually down, which is mind-boggling. But what you've had is the government debt's gone way up, and it's crowded out the consumer, and the corporate have actually delevered. And while that's happened, on the right-hand side, the correlation between stocks and bonds, even though inflation started right after COVID, but even though inflation's come down, which is the purple line, the correlation between stocks and bonds has stayed high. And so that, to me, tells me that bonds can't be the traditional shock absorber in the portfolio. And that is if you do asset allocation, that's a massive insight. And I think it's going to be exacerbated by the fact that when we get, you saw this in April, you get down days in equities, bond yields going up, and you get a weaker dollar. for KKR and probably for you guys, that sets off risk alarms. So we're spending a lot of our time trying to make sure that we mitigate that kind of triple threat of weaker equities, higher bond yields, and weaker dollar. And it leads me to, you know, the punchline, which is most of the people on the Zoom grew up in this lower left quadrant, which was low growth, low inflation, tight fiscal, loose monetary. And we went through, we did experiments with QE, and all that led to, even though we had poor productivity during the 2010 decade, markets did okay because we manipulated rates. Now we're moving up to a higher nominal GDP environment where we'll probably have more volatility. We call this a regime change driven by heightened geopolitics, bigger deficits, messy energy transition, and ultimately stickier inflation. And so we own more real assets in our portfolio. We're doing more operational improvements. We're doing less sponsor to sponsor. And in credit, we're getting higher up in the capital structure. And the catalyst, or what you see on the right-hand side here, which is we're having a fundamental breakdown in what real rates are doing and what the dollar is doing. And those have to make you think about asset allocation differently. So that's, you know, we can get into, I'll get into different things, but the punchline is this time is different. And, you know, we can't control what the government's going to do, but we can control how we tilt our portfolios. And our advice would be more collateral-based cash flows, more operational improvement stories, a little more non-U.S., and not being massively overweight duration. So that's the way I think about the macro landscape. So let me pause there. I'm happy to take any questions on this or move to kind of take you around the world a little bit in terms of what we're seeing. Okay. So I'm going to spend 1 second on the U.S., which is our fundamental model is telling us 2.9% GDP. You know, when you adjust for the taxes and the tariffs and spending, you get to kind of 1.5 to 2%. We're, you know, most of our investments are 5 to 10 years, so that's probably not as relevant. I think on the right hand side, which has been very relevant, this is something we started maybe 20 years ago, where we look at 10 inputs and we say, where do those 10 inputs line up in the economic cycle? Contraction, early cycle, mid cycle, late cycle. And what's happened since COVID that never happened during my 13 years at Morgan Stanley is the many of the inputs are across, it looks like a scatter plot. They're across all the different sectors. Like in the old days, all 10 would be in contraction or all 10 would be in early cycle. And we would be in a world where the U.S. consumer or corporate would lever up and buy, Europe and China would produce, and we had a synchronized global recovery until we had a deleveraging event. This time, we're actually having none of that. We're having an asynchronous recovery where we've had a manufacturing recession, a services acceleration. We've had Europe do well, China do poorly, and I don't think we're going to have a normal cycle. And so I think you could pick up the headline, the paper every day and be super bearish or be super bullish. And I think it's this rolling recovery, rolling recessions. And so in that world, the key thing is to maintain linear deployment, right? I think you've heard this, you know, time and time again from KKR. We want to put our money to work over a 4 to 5 year period. We want to diversify the portfolio. We want to see what the market's giving us and be aggressive. And that is really something we've been adhering to since 2020, and it's frankly led to better loss rates across all our portfolios. Second key point is just on the U.S. is around productivity. I mentioned this again, the big productivity decades, the 60s, the 90s, and what we've seen the last 8 quarters, they just lead to better results. And what you see on the right hand side is if productivity is growing kind of 1 to 2% in the U.S., tech is booming. Retail trade is automating a lot faster. Oil, if you think about shale, professional services, digitalization. And then you have parts of the economy that aren't modernizing with technology. And you see that in things such as manufacturing, utilities, construction. But when you look at where we're trying to invest, the productivity sectors are growing their EBITDA about 50% faster than the overall market, which is a that these are public statistics, but we see a similar trend in our private portfolio where we've really focused on digitalization and automation. Things have done much, much better. I'm going to skip through Europe and just spend 1 second on China. China, I think, is in a deflation. It's very similar to what happened to the U.S. after 2007 and 2008. They're having a housing bust. They probably had 60 million too many homes. Maybe today it's 30. You can see that it's still a big drag on growth. What people aren't talking about, though, in China is that, you know, when you look at that digitalization and the green transition, they've totally revolutionized their economy. They are the global leader in industrial automation, and it is allowing them to, as their workforce shrinks, to be incredibly powerful. And you've seen this across autos, other parts of industrials where they're able to export, you know, less so to the U.S., but when you look at the right-hand side, they are becoming much more competitive in Korea, Japan, Germany, to some degree the U.S. And I just got back from Africa. China's everywhere. They're a major, major force. And so despite all the tariffs that we put on them and despite the deflation they're having, this economy is doing fine. So you end up in a global situation where you've got two superpowers that are to some degree decoupling. And I think they'll go about it in very different ways. The U.S. will continue to use its consumption prowess to negotiate tariffs, and China is going to use its export and fixed investment prowess to make sure that it aligns with other places around the world. And I think those are important differences relative to the intertwined world that we had for China coming in the WTO in 2001. So very different backdrop globally than where we have been. Let me pause there. Anything on the economics? Okay. I'm going to dial down a little bit to be a little more near term on why I think the market's going to continue to go up despite people being negative about it. And I say that knowing that we've been up 55% in the past 2 years. Number one is, in the 35 years I've been doing this, this is the best single technical backdrop that we've ever had, right? When you look at, I was a brokerage analyst at Morgan Stanley. One of the things I used to track was IPOs, levered loans, and high yield issuance is a percentage of GDP. And we're back to 2009's levels, but the economy is materially stronger. There's no net supply coming to the market. And that actually generally, you can see it on the right-hand side. When you look at the relative performance, when you have that lack of supply, private markets actually perform really, really well. And so when the S&P doesn't perform as well, it does quite strongly as well. So if we're going into a less robust period for the S&P, the illiquidity premium should do well. If you look at the left-hand side, that lack of supply, I mean, we own an insurance company, and every day I go down there, and I see this from all our insurance clients, they don't have enough net supply to meet the annuity sales that are occurring in the U.S., right? Pre-COVID, we used to do $100 billion of annuity sales in the industry. Today, it's $400 billion. More and more retirees want upfront income. And so my overall view is, given where the risk-free rate is, credit spreads are going to stay much tighter this cycle than in the past, and that it's the absolute all-in yield that's important than the relative credit spread, and banks don't need to delever. So I would say the setup, you got the S&P is buying back $1 trillion, you have very little IPOs, and you have no levered loans or high yield issuance, and that is creating an extraordinarily strong technical bid. So even though you have these geopolitical and fiscal deficit concerns, the market doesn't trade the way some people would think. So that would be point one on the bull case. Case two would be just that global central banks, I always measure the top 25 global central banks. Are they tightening? Are they easing? You know, if you wanted to be bearish, go back to, you know, this page. In 21, net issuance was almost 8% of GDP, and it didn't include SPACs. You were dousing the market with low quality issuance. and this didn't even include SPACs. You throw SPACs on that, probably the biggest issuance bubble we've had in my career, probably worse than 2000. Today, you're nowhere near. At the same time that you were having that massive issuance, it led to a huge amount of tightening. You had 84% of the global central banks tightening because you had excess in the capital markets and you had inflation. Today, you have about 8% of the global central banks tightening. And when you look at the right-hand side, when the Fed is easing and you don't have a recession, which is our base view, you typically have a pretty nice period of performance for stocks. And that's exactly what we've had since the Fed started on their easing campaign. So probably not the way we would want it, because it's been a lot of, you know, hand-wringing, but actually pretty good market. So the dark blue line is starting to catch up, you know, after Liberation Day with where we think it's going to track, which is the purple line, which is no recession, Fed is easing. We have the Fed doing 2 this year and 3 next year to get rates down to a more competitive spot relative to other central banks around the world.
Hey, Henry, this is Rex. If you could maybe go back to slide 20, I have a question for you about your metric there. Okay, so that is as a percentage of IPO, high yield bond, and leveraged loan issuance. But obviously, the private credit world has grown quite dramatically. How does that picture change if you include that?
It moves it up a little bit. It's a great question, and we've checked this out internally. It doesn't move it up. It moves it up like a percent. It's not as it's actually not as dramatic. If you wanted to say where the market was over issuing, it would be 2 areas. One is government bonds, and one is investment grade debt. Those are the areas. The private credit. I mean, you know, I run risk here too, and so I. If one is a green, like there's no risk, and you know 9 or 10 is like, oh my goodness, we're at a on debt right now, we're at like a 1. I think our debt risk that we're syndicating and our revolver risk is at a 10-year low. It's pretty extraordinary. So I do think that the private credit would move it up. But the truth is that there's not enough M&A. And I know the Fed doesn't want to encourage M&A because it's risk-taking, but the numbers are abnormally low even with private credit.
Right. Thank you. That's helpful.
Yep. Okay. And then the last thing I was just going to mention, well, 2 things. One is we've been pretty bullish on oil for years, and we have a very negative view on oil. So I think part of the Trump administration agenda is to keep lower oil prices, and that's very bullish for growth and consumer spending. Frankly, it offsets a lot of the tariff increases. It kind of leads me to my last point. This is the same model that we've had since I started doing macro at Morgan Stanley in 2003. The yellow line is predicted growth, and it's at 8%. For the next 12 months. And when you go through it, lower oil prices, weaker dollar, credit spreads aren't blowing out, and you're not having a huge housing downturn. So when you look at the leading indicators from our standpoint, they're not crazy bullish, but they're definitely not they're not super poor. And I would just highlight, a lot of people look and say, well, the ISM in the manufacturing sector has been below 50. It's been below 50 for 27 out of 29 months, which is a crazy number. The only other time you've seen that was in 1994 and 1995, when you didn't have a recession. And so the typical sell side strategist would tell you that you should get out of equities when the ISM is below 50. There's usually been a very high correlation. This cycle, it broke down. And again, it gets back to my productivity point. The 1990s, you had massive productivity. We didn't get a recession despite a bond market massacre in 94, as well as a weak ISM. This time we had a bond market massacre in 2022. We've had the ISM below 50 for 27 out of 29 months, and we haven't had a recession. And again, it gets back to, I think we've had more productivity this cycle that's allowed for wage growth and allowed for the services economy to grow. I think I'll pause there and maybe shift to like, where are we deploying capital in the private markets, if that, unless there are questions. Okay. All right. Let me start with a more simple one, which is just capital heavy to capital light, right? This one I really picked up from our insurance company, where we see lots of insurers that are selling us their book. We see this. We did a deal with Discover. Lennar Housing Company doesn't want to own land because the home builders now want to get their multiple re-rated. You're seeing this with corporate carve-outs. This is probably the single biggest thing affecting our deal flow at KKR. Companies are transitioning from wanting to own intensive receivables or assets on their balance sheet to recycle that cash to either grow or to buy back stock. And that's leading to a wide dispersion in the global capital markets. And this is wildly bullish for what we're doing in private equity, corporate carve-outs, two deals with, if you look at S&P Global, two deals, they've sold us subsidiaries in the U.S., Japan, we've done three with Hitachi. And then on the credit side is really where it's exploding. The same way that Wall Street saw the securitization market go into real estate, that's now happening across all different asset classes, and it's leading to buyers and sellers from the corporate sector, fincos, traditional financial services, to be able to monetize these receivable earning streams and allow others, including KKR, and to bid on that. So it's really a structuring play. And so that's probably, if I had to say, where is this taking place at our, you know, most active around the world, that would be it. The second one, not surprisingly, is this theme. We've moved from benign globalization to one of great power competition. And so you could get very negative and say, supply chains are broken, I don't want to take that risk. The offset of that is it's leading to a huge amount of resiliency, right? When we survey KKR's 150 companies and we ask CEOs what they want resiliency of data, transportation, water, food. And that's actually leading to, excuse me, a huge amount of building, right? Our companies, our supply chains used to have one manufacturer. That was China. That same company today has one in Japan, Mexico, the United States, in addition to China. And being able to follow those chains and think about how it, you know, cyber threats, and to think about warehouse storage and logistics and where are we short assets. That has been, it's almost like a foil to everything that's going on in the world. And that's been particularly for our infrastructure business, has been a huge growth driver. The third one, I'm going to sound like a broken record, is productivity. When wages go up 2-3%, companies spend a lot on making sure that they can protect margins. And you see this around the world. You know, U.S. wages are still growing north of 3%, very similar in what we're seeing in Europe. And you see companies looking for ways, digitalization, automation. Clearly AI is a play on that, but this has really been basic blocking and tackling around software benefits. Last point I would make on this page is just on the right-hand side. This is the data I talked about on worker retraining. You can see the U.S. spends 10 basis points on worker retraining from a government standpoint, and we're more indebted now. So that's got to get taken up by the private sector. And so this has led to a lot of interesting things around kind of human capital investments, matching companies with the skills training, figuring out how do you create graduates in areas where they don't have to maybe go to college, but they could be a really good steel welder or a plumber or different skill sets that maybe don't require a college degree. And so trying to make sure that there's some really interesting things from a societal standpoint that you can do to help universities and educational institutions actually prepare their curriculum to better serve where there's demand for workers. And so that's something we've been spending a lot of time on as a firm, and we've been able to invest behind it and do well for our LPs similarly. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on AI. I think most people know that. I'll close just with this one, which is, look, frankly, governments took on too much debt after COVID, and you can see this on the last left-hand side. Major advanced economies in the G7, their debt to cap, debt to GDP went from 117% to 126%. And that's happening in a time where we need to massively upgrade our infrastructure. And you can see this on the right-hand side. You know, a lot of people talk to us about data centers, and that's in the telecom bucket. That pales in comparisons to ports and power and other more traditional forms of infrastructure. So one of my premises is, and I see this at some of the investment committees I work on, everything from space to transportation to logistics, a lot of that's going to have to go renewables. A lot of that's going to have to go into the private sector because the public sector does not have the debt capacity to take on more more areas. You've seen in the United Kingdom where their bond markets got rattled. France clearly has a fair amount of debt. U.S. is headed that way. And then obviously Japan has an extraordinary amount of debt, though they do benefit from local ownership of their debt. Last thing I'll close on is just expected returns. Not surprisingly, given we start with high margins and, you know, fairly robust valuations, but our base view is that expected returns will be lower across the board. That probably doesn't come as a huge surprise. I do think a couple of things to call out here. One is we've thrown in the towel on small cap being having a renaissance. I think most of the good small cap companies are, frankly, getting bought by the private markets, and they're not. So you look today, the Russell 2000 has one third of the sectors of the indexes doesn't make money. We have our non-U.S. equities higher than the U.S. for the first time. I think the bigger point is on the left-hand side of this page 39, which is we're exiting a period where we suppressed rates and then put too much money in the system, where the gap between the best performing asset classes and the worst performing asset classes was actually the widest in the 15 years we've been doing this. And now you have a much narrower outcome. So you either need to find more upfront yield, find more non-correlated assets, or find managers that can deliver alpha above the median return. That's really the point of this page. And we've been spending a lot of time with our clients just thinking through ways to create optimized portfolios that do those three things: non-correlated, more upfront yield, linkage to nominal GDP, and how do we create some alpha through operational improvement where you can kind of make your own luck. And that's really, I guess I would sum up there and just can go to, you know, we've talked about this before on pacing on page 40. Nobody's got a crystal ball. I take a fair amount of confidence. If you look at KKR on the right-hand side, none of our funds got really bullish or got really bearish. We have deployed linearly since, you know, really over the last 5 to 10 years, and that's led to less downside, right? We've put less leverage on the companies. We've been diversified and ultimately ended up with better outcomes. So portfolio construction has become a bigger part of what we have done. So I'm happy to, you know, we went through a lot. I can take the slides down and we can get into Q&A. Hopefully some of that was relevant to how you guys are thinking about the world. You know, these are our, you know, I would say, if you have a chance to look at the note, these are what I call variant perception, which is always try to think about what's in the market. These are probably the 7 or 8 things where KKR has a very different view than the consensus. Lower oil, deleveraging, and big debt leads to currency weakness, not the long end getting unglued. Productivity drives the cycle longer. Europe actually will do better. Private equity will actually perform better than what people think. Infrastructure is a bigger opportunity set. We talked about labor, where unemployment rate doesn't go up because there's no immigration anymore. And the U.S. markets, we actually think, are reasonably valued. You've got a much better quality bias in terms of what's going on. So quite a few things to chew on there. But happy to, again, thank you for your time and thank you for your support, and happy to take any questions if you have them.
So unless there's anyone else that wants to jump in, Treasurer Center, I saw you.
You're surprised to have a question, Rick? I'm so
no,
sure
please,
you're terribly
please
surprised
to jump
that
in.
I have a question. So as you probably know, I spent 13 years in the legislature before I became treasurer. And during that time, I mostly did budget, including a lot of work on our pension system, and saw the impact of how well-funded OPERF is on local government, any government entity's budget, right? Because the better we do, the less they have to put in on a day-to-day basis. So I guess my question is this. How do we start thinking, if we're taking a broader picture of looking at the state economy, how do we start looking at the fact that we've got, and this may be beyond, but how do we think about communicating with other parts of government? I guess is really the question that we don't necessarily see, given the complexity that you're describing of investing and the narrowing of that range that was on one of your last slides. I guess I see us doing fine, but I don't see us doing spectacularly well with OPERP over the next X years. And that means that we don't have the capacity to lower rates for other governments at a time when federal funding's dropping for a lot of the local government functions, you know, school districts, things like that. That's a somewhat, it may be outside the scope of your presentation, and if so, please tell me to go jump in a lake. But that's something I think about using my old legislator budget hat, right?
Well, I think figuring out forums where you can communicate something on expected returns, I think is really important, because we've been in an extraordinary period, particularly given quantitative easing. Like, what happened over the past 10 years until probably 2021 is not going to be replicated, which is most everybody on this Zoom grew up when the Fed's balance sheet was 6% of GDP. It went to 34 during from 2009 to 2021. It went from 6 to 34. And that created excess return because you suppressed the risk-free rate. And I think having some discussion on the base amount of return, what you can do in the public markets and the private markets, is really important to tell your narrative. I think the second thing is, and I'm obviously biased, but it's the title of our mid-year piece, which is, given that backdrop, we are over-indexing to things where we can create upside skew through some form of operational improvement or protect the downside, which is, even in those median returns, which you know, I've been doing for a long time, when you look at some of the private markets, particularly private equity, the gap between the top quartile and the bottom quartile is massive. If you do that in large cap growth, it's much smaller, or fixed income. So my message would be is there are certain parts of the market where you can create a much better outcome than the median return. You have to have confidence, and if it's us or whoever, we have to deliver on lower loss rates than in the past, and we've got to deliver on the operational upside. Like, I know from our 49-year history that corporate carve-outs have a better return than our regular private equity, and not that our regular private equity is doing poorly. We need to do more of those in this environment to drive outcomes. And so there's a holistic conversation about the macro, which I'm happy to take offline, about why expected returns will be lower, because you're not going to have as much government intervention in the capital markets. And then the second thing is, this group collectively has to land the plane somehow on where you think you're going to create the excess return. I obviously sit in one seat. I spent, you know, 15 years on the public markets. I have, you know, have views there. I sit on the private markets right now, but you know, where can you create significant outperformance, right? We mentioned, like, I think India is going to be a long-term outperformer market. So I'd want to be overweight there. I think in private equity and public equities, Japan is going to be a very strong market. I think Rex had, you know, had talked about direct lending. Like, I'm really drilling down right now on direct lending, given that rates have stayed higher for longer, to make sure that the loss rates, right? Because in our insurance company, we outsource to managers just like you do. And so I'm spending a lot of time thinking through who's, you know, a B is an A and a C is an F, right? And so there are things like that that I think you have to think through as a, you know, as an investment committee. So probably more than you wanted, but those would be my, those would be some initial thoughts. I'm happy to follow up offline and
no, that's a great starting point, and it's making me think, you know, Mr. Olenek from PERS is on this call also, because he's ex officio on OIC, and it feels like a conversation needs to be convened between him and probably Carl Riccadonna, our state economist, and me and Rex and, you know, a couple other people, because this is going to take a holistic, we have to take a holistic approach to thinking about this. And it's not just what we're doing here at Treasury, but it's how do we convey this through the PERS board and through what the state economist is saying, and, you know, the impacts on all sorts of public services that are going to be affected by this. I'm not trying to sow doom and gloom, and I don't think you are either. I'm just trying to be realistic as we think about a very, I mean, to some extent, it's a counter-cyclical problem, right, where the federal government's putting in less money, and we may, as a result of that and other actions that they're doing, we may not be getting quite as good returns, which means that that public employers may need to contribute more than, right? So it's an interesting problem. It's kind of like the need for social services goes up during a recession when you have less income coming to the state.
Yeah, right? I think the simple thing, I mean, one simple analysis you could do is just do a 70-30 stock bond, show what it's been doing and how far it's on a trailing basis, how far it's been above trend, and then put that up against government debt. And yeah. I think you would prove the point. Anyway, yeah. We're happy
thank
to be helpful.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee that might be of interest?
I think Lori might have a question.
Yeah. Just overall, what I'm taking away from these discussions is that, we, you know, as we move into our asset allocation exercises in this coming year, I would expect that we would be seeing lower projected overall rates of return in future years than we have seen previously. Maybe not significantly, but Rex, would you agree with that?
I think it's kind of hard to say. I think the way I would look at it is base rates are higher by quite a bit, right? So the starting point, sort of quote-unquote risk-free rate is higher, possibly offsetting some of the lower expected return from beta. But I think where we are positioned strong is the fact that our portfolio is largely active at this point. Right, we do have a high allocation to private markets, which is active. We have a high allocation to non-U.S. assets as well. And then our public markets are more constrained, so maybe we could have a conversation there. But I think we're pretty well positioned from a base rate of return, but also trying to take advantage of all these sort of active opportunities that we've heard KKR and also Bridgewater talk about.
Yeah, I would build on that. I mean, I think what Rex said is really important, which is the risk-free rate. You know, the downside is you don't have the government suppressing rates, which increase the multiples on stocks. The offset of that is you can get because the risk-free rate is higher, you can get a better risk-adjusted return in certain areas because there's something there. So I do think, learning to your point, like, this is a time to think through the asset allocation and what your bogey is. I mean, you guys have done more in non-US. You know, I think there are things that you've done more in privates. I think there are things where you're well positioned. I think what we're trying to push people on is there's been a fair amount of people been way overweight the U.S., both U.S. equities and U.S. Bonds. And certainly on those bonds, we would say there are other things you can do with the money, or you could at a minimum shorten the duration and find some competitive return per unit of risk. So I don't think the sky is falling, but I do think, as I mentioned at the outstart, I do think it's a different environment, and there are puts and takes with that. And I do think the day of just like, hey, I'm not going to own any credit or any fixed income, and I'm going to be super long duration equities. That is probably compressed, right? And so, you know, you see the area that's getting hit more than you guys and others is like the endowment community that was really long some venture capital, or where these were, you know, the research funding's going down in biotech, and then they were expecting on more and more funding and some of these longer duration investments where you really needed a high PE versus some other things that have cash flow, where I feel like you guys probably have a better exposure than some too.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful.
Yep. Hey, and Lorraine, to your question.
Oh.
No, I was just saying, Lorraine, to your question, it appears, it's probably a good thing that we're doing the asset liability study next year, just timing wise, and having this conversation around the rates of return and our expectations.
Yeah.
Hey, Henry, and this might go to Treasurer Steiner's earlier comment and question. I'm just curious, just a general question, and you're optimistic, and I'm not Debbie Downer here, but what's keeping you up at night as it relates to macroeconomics?
Yeah. I think that there are a couple of things. I think one is none of us really know. We can look at history around deficits, but we are doing a scientific experiment, right? And our view is that's going to manifest itself in a weaker dollar and not the long 10-year rates and 20-year rates going materially higher. But were that to happen, that would be problematic for most things that we do. So it would, you know, you get more surrenders of annuities. You would get more people that take money out of bank deposits because they could buy cash. And you saw a little bit of that with SVB. So rapid rise increases in rates because people just lose confidence in, you know, this is the first time since, I mean, we haven't talked about this. This is the first time since 1917 that the U.S. government has not had the highest rating from any of the one of the three rating agencies. So at a minimum, you have to say that's different. That's number one. And then look, number two is, I spend a lot of time overseas and, you know, what's happening, whether it's Iran or, China or Russia, These are, you know, I was a history major, University of Virginia. I mean, there are eerie things that would remind you of pre-World War I or pre-World War II, where you have people that, you know, that come and say things that get misinterpreted, right? Like General Petraeus works here. And if you ask him about what's going on in the South China Sea, it probably would make you, you know, wake up at night, which is the U.S. and China are, planes are flying right next to each other and doing things that make you nervous. So those are probably the two biggies. Rates move up much faster than I thought, or there's some geopolitical shock. I think structurally, if we kill the fatted calf in the U.S. economy, it will be that we hurt productivity. And all the stuff that happened around Liberation Day, productivity, we had one quarter that was minus 1.8%. We've been running at like plus two or above for 12 quarters, and we had a real pothole. If you don't have productivity and you have too much money in the system with big government debt, you get stagflation, and that would be more of a slow burn, but that's the third one.
Hey, thank you. I wanted to follow up on something, and I'm happy to take this offline. You had mentioned, and I'll try to paraphrase, reskilling, upskilling. And so can you say a little bit more about that? And I think the comment was around having the private markets lean in. I think that's what you said.
Something. Yeah. So yeah. I think there are a couple of things. One, I'll give you a 30-second advertisement. I mean, we're doing a lot in our companies with something called employee ownership, where we're doing financial literacy. We're giving equity ownership to everybody across the company. And that is leading to better outcomes. Coupled with that is we're investing a lot behind companies that are helping to place workers who either get displaced with the, where there's demand for workers. Like part of what's happening or what happened is a lot of Americans took on a lot of debt to get a basic college degree and they were not skilled for what the world needed. And that, I think somebody, I can't remember who asked this earlier, but that's, it's happening at a time where technology change is accelerating. That is not great. There are lots of things that we can do as a society and also down to, you know, what you guys do and what we do, where we can allocate capital to firms that are matching buyers and sellers of skills. And so there's some really neat companies, you know, and Tony, we can follow up with some of the things we've done, but where literally we're finding out, we're scraping websites on where there's job openings, and we're taking those to universities and telling the universities what people need, or they may not have to go to a university. They may actually be somebody who wants to be a steel worker but doesn't want to go get a four-year degree and take on a lot of debt. So it's a broad issue, but there's a ton that we can do. And I think that the government has a lot on its plate. I think there are things, particularly in the U.S. and Europe, that we've been finding that are pretty neat things that will help to do that. I'd say a lot of the hand wringing I get is AI is going to displace all these jobs. And I think some of that is going to happen and be painful. The offset is that our immigration, given that we're tightening the border, we actually don't have enough people to meet the jobs that we need, or we have people to do it, but we don't have them. They don't have the right skill set to do it. And so those are things that I think that your organization and our organization could rally behind, that there's a real role for capital allocation at the pension level and certainly in the private markets to fund these companies. And I don't think we need the government to do that. And frankly, I think we'll get a better outcome.
Can I follow up really quickly on something you just said, which is not related to your presentation, but I think is important. It's important to me. Financial literacy is critically important, and it's something that is vastly underachieved in this country. So I'm very interested in what you said about how you all are working on building out that out. Would you have somebody on your team who knows more about that?
Yeah. I mean,
follow up with me, because I would love to have a longer conversation with that person and a couple other people. Barry Ford, who's on this call, is our chief program officer. Ryan Mann from our savings network. That would be super helpful to me.
Okay. I mean, I know we're over time, but I mean, there are simple things that you can do. Like you have them open up an account at Fidelity, even though we're not putting real stock in there. We put private stock, but then they have to think about how it moves and it appreciates. And then they start to think about financial planning, and just getting the mindset going is a huge breakthrough. And it's crazy to me that even in private universities, we actually don't spend enough time on that. Anyway, we have a lot.
You're not going to get any argument from me about that. I completely agree. So yes, I would very much appreciate the opportunity to have a longer conversation with you all about that. Thank you.
So Tony, let's follow up, and I'll wrap up. But to me, one is around the employee ownership and the financial literacy. The second is around some of our portfolio companies in terms of the worker retraining. And then, you know, look, I would just close with a couple of thoughts. One is thank you for the opportunity to speak with the group, and we obviously appreciate the support and the long partnership. And then second is just a degree of humility, which is I have I've been doing this for a while. This is a complicated time as I've been through. And so I think what you hear in our voice is we're trying to find ways to minimize risk, but create structures where we protect downside and have some upside skew. Like our message is.
I think we froze up here.
Did we lose him?
Yeah.
Henry, just give him a sec. I think it'll.
Yeah.
We'll take it from there. Okay.
Henry, we all lost about the last 30 seconds of what you said. It froze up. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Just real quickly, all I was saying is we'll do the follow-up and just one thank you. And then the final thing is, like, I say this with a great deal of humility, which is this is a complicated time. And I think what you hear from us is we're trying to create structures where we protect downside but have some upside optionality. Our message is not to go take an inordinate amount of risk. This is a time to be very directed and thoughtful about portfolio construction, pacing, where you're leaning in. But anyway, I know I'm over. I'm happy to help any way I can, and thank you. Okay.
Thank you
very
Henry.
Much.
We really appreciate it. Have a great
day.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
So the last item is open discussion. I'm not, to be honest, expecting any open discussion, but if there is anything, we could definitely have a bit of time for that.
It's not an open discussion, but Rex, you and Kira, whoever put this together today, was very informative and enlightening and right on time, given some discussions I've been having. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Agree. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, the next meeting is in September. We'll get the ball rolling on getting everyone prepped for that, and enjoy the rest of the summer. And hopefully the heat wave here in Portland and Oregon cools off a little bit.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you.